Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest this week is Amy Dickinson, perhaps best known as the writer of the popular advice column Ask Amy, which is carried in more than 150 newspapers and read by an estimated 22 million readers daily. In addition to her work as a writer, you may have also heard Amy on the NPR quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. All of these experiences made for a fascinating conversation as Amy talks about juggling life as an advice columnist and her own experiences with parenthood and marriage. We also talk about her life of faith as Amy is a member of a United Methodist Church in her hometown in Freeville, New York. I've enjoyed all my Failing Boldly conversations, but this was certainly one of my favorites. I hope you enjoy it. Amy Dickinson, thank you so much for being on the Failing Boldly podcast.
I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled to, well, to fail boldly. It's sort of my brand, so yeah.
Welcome to the club. It was really interesting to read. I read an article about how you became Ask Amy. So first I was wondering if you could, for those who haven't read the article, talk a little bit about that. And I'm also curious, at what point in your life did you think this might be something that A, I'd be good at, and B, would be really fun?
Yeah. So many people, it turns out, I think so many of us are armchair advisors. I never would have put myself in that category. I'm the youngest of four children, all born very, very close together. And I have, as the youngest in my family, I've always been more on the receiving end of a lot of unsolicited advice. But I was a journalist. I had a column at Time magazine. I'd written about parenting for several years. I had a real interest in sort of parenting, children, relationships. And I had started this column at Time magazine, and it went very well. The column was discontinued right after 9/11, as Time switched its coverage from softer things. And so I was out of work, and I was freelancing, really struggling. And I was doing some freelancing for the Chicago Tribune and other newspapers. And Ann Landers died. And her editor actually at the Tribune, Jim Warren, contacted me, and he kept offering me jobs, and I kept turning them down because I did not want to be a full-time newspaper reporter. I was a single mother, very ensconced, and did not want to take that on. And after Ann Landers died, I very jokingly sent Jim an email, and I said, now there's a job I could do, ha, ha, ha. And he took me up on it. They had many, many, many scores of people coming out of the woodwork who wanted to take on that advice column job. And at first, the Chicago Tribune said, we're getting out of that business. But after a month or two, probably looking at the balance sheet, they decided to go back into the advice column business. And they conducted a nationwide search for the next Ann Landers, basically, or the new Ann Landers. And, you know, furthering my dream to really be in a Busby Berkeley musical, the star broke her ankle, and I auditioned. And they test marketed, I think, 10 people. It was really cool. They gave us each 5 sample questions, all actually from Ann Landers' columns. This is pre-internet, so you couldn't just look them up and answer them. And they gave each of us the same 5 questions, and we all got a week to answer them. And here's where I think I really won the job, honestly. I answered the questions in a day, and I sent my answers back to Jim Warren. And he said, I'm not even going to look at these. Please take a week. Everybody gets a week. Take it. And I thought to myself, you know, given a week, I'd just screw it up. You know how you do?
Plus, as a columnist, I would think, I mean, you have to churn these out.
Yeah. It's daily.
Right.
And I knew Ann Landers was really fast, and I'm fast. And I thought, no, I don't. And there was something about the immediacy of the way I answered them. A couple of them, my answers really, I thought, kind of funny. I did a little reporting, and I really liked what I'd done. And I just thought, no, I don't want to worry about this. I don't want to tone it down. If they wanted me to do this column, this is exactly how I would do it. I actually loved the audition. I thought, oh, I got this, you know, which is pretty rare. And I won the prize. They test marketed all of the auditions were test marketed in front of like a bunch of focus groups, which is so bold, isn't it? Like focus group was so silly. But anyway.
Well, in the article, you may be being a little modest. At least in the article anyway, Jim Warren had given it to a handful of people. I can't remember where he was staying. And they didn't put the names on who the respondents were. And it was unanimous that your responses were the ones that everybody liked the most.
And that was sort of a friends and family little test that he did. But they also pulled together professional focus groups and actually test marketed the columns. And my understanding was that all of the focus groups had the same response, which is that... number one, they wanted to bring Ann Landers back from the dead. Like, that was the one, you know, that was everybody's first choice. I think I came in second, so I got the job.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you don't mind walking me and us through the process. I'm fascinated by, I can't imagine how many letters and emails come in. And so both the process of deciding what to print and... I'm also curious, once you decide what to respond to, what is your own, how do you go through answering it? For example, I might imagine, like, what is this person like? Where are they sitting? What do they look like? And then answering, or kind of what your own process is for that.
Mm-hmm. So now that we are all reachable across platforms, questions come into me through every imaginable portal. Including Facebook messages, tweets. I get questions on Tumblr. I get lots and lots of emails, which is my email address is published in the column. So I get between 200 and 300 emails a day.
Wow.
Which, when you think about it, it's actually my biggest job is finding the questions and really trawling through the email. Requests. Lots of those emails are responding to previous columns, so okay. They go in one category. And I choose questions the way anybody would. I always think that my background in radio helped me a lot with the column, because the very first thing I did that I think was so smart was I decided not to rewrite the questions. When I read other advice columns, sometimes I feel like the questions have been smoothed out. And I assume because of my background in radio, I love the way people tell their story. They're always burying the lead. You know, like any question that starts with, my husband and I have been happily married for 40 years. I'm like, we'll see. You know, we'll see about that. So I really like the way people tell their own story. So I do think my column is distinguished by having real voices. My questions tend to be a little on the long side because people get a little rambly, but I'm cool with that. Mm-hmm. So I choose questions that any reader would want to read. I'm fascinated by... addiction. I'm fascinated by any family relationship, any family drama. I just filed my week's... Wednesdays are my Fridays, so I just filed a week's worth of columns. Okay. And I had one I really loved, and it was sort of a pedestrian, very common question about a sister who felt like her older sister just never liked her. And as adults, like, does she need to be friends with her sister? And the way she wrote her question, inspired me to do something I've never really done. Here was a line in her question that really sparked it. She said, after all, her sister's 8 years older. She's like, after all, my sister and I were raised by the same parents in the same household. And I was like, not really. Mm. She also had a middle sibling. I said, by the time you came along, your parents were 8 years older and had two other children. And I suggested that her bossy eldest sister probably had a hand in raising her. Mm. And the dynamic she described in their adulthood was that this sister was still at it and wouldn't stop. And so I suggested that this person look into birth order. And I recommended a book about birth order. And I said, this information is not going to help you get along better, but it will give you insight and it may make you feel differently about her behavior.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a pretty common question, but I just sometimes the way people express themselves makes me think, oh, here's an opportunity for a new look at a really common question.
Over the years, when you decide how to answer, are you drawing on your years of wisdom now and doing this for so long? Or books that you've read, like you cited the one, mm-hmm. or is it a combination of both?
It's a true combination. Yeah. In fact, I've started doing something over the last 3 years that a few people have noticed, and that is I'm injecting a lot more personal storytelling in my answers, and I'm being much more personally revealing. I actually had an agent in Los Angeles because I've written a book and we're going to maybe make a TV show. Maybe not. Maybe. Anyway, he contacted me and he said, wow, what happened? 3 years ago, you started being much more Amy on the page. Mm. And I was shocked that he had noticed that. But for instance, this week in this batch of columns, I got a question from somebody who said, my boss seems to be having an affair with a coworker. And I don't care. I don't want to know, but it's affected the entire office. It's certainly affected my ability to do my job. And she explained exactly why. And I said, oh, that happened in a previous life of mine, in a previous career. I had two senior colleagues engage in an affair. And it completely transformed our office because neither one of them was available. It was hours out of every day. You know, the door was closed or they were gone.
Physically, literally, they were not.
Gone. And then the one colleague inside with the door closed and you were not to interrupt. You know, it was incredibly destructive to our office dynamic completely. So I included that in there. You know, so this is a personal situation that I felt like I felt comfortable including. So I have lots of stepchildren. I am a grandparent. I am in a second marriage. I took care of my mother before she died. I have had such personal experience with a lot of these dilemmas mm-hmm. that people are laying at my feet. So I'm feeling much more comfortable drawing on my own personal experience. Part of my professional experience is reading up on the latest thinking, the latest studies. In, 16, 17 years of writing this column, the thinking about a lot of these issues has really changed a lot.
Yeah.
And so it's important, you know, I feel it's important that I sort of keep pace with that.
Yeah. What do you think? I've been reading, for my profession as a pastor, I've been reading a little bit, some articles about the declining influence of clergy in society. So it used to be they may not go to therapy, but they would go to their clergy person. And that seems like it's been declining. And it seems like therapy has been on the uprise. But what seems to me over the years, there have been lots of different advice columnists, people are willing to ask questions to somebody that they've never met before.
Yes.
Have you thought about that? Why that is?
Yes. I think it's because you are, in fact, Christian, I'll have people contact me often, you know, yelling, upset at something I've written, and I'll get back to them and say, hey, man, come on, you know, like express. Yeah. I insist that people respect themselves, or I insist that people express themselves respectfully. Mm-hmm. It's like I'm the one person left on Twitter who has never used the F word. And, you know, I'm getting to be sort of known for that. And I just insist on it.
Yeah.
And I'll say, dude, come on. Like, if you want to tell me something, you got to use different language.
Yeah.
They will always say, like, oh, I didn't think anybody was reading this.
Oh.
So I think some of it is people venting. Honestly, I think some of it is I'm no longer a stranger to a lot of people.
Mm.
I believe that when people write to me, they are just as, you know, when people wrote to Ann Landers,
yeah.
they knew what they were
yeah.
going to get a, like, wake up and smell the coffee, bub. I know I always impersonate her like she's chewing a cigar. I'm aware of that. But when they write to me, I think they actually do know what they're going to get.
Mm.
And it might be a bit of a slap upside the head, but I also, I like to think that I infuse most of my answers with a lot of compassion toward people.
But also, I mean, and I say this as a compliment, I think, not blunt, but you're very forthright. If you, yeah. you call things out, but mm-hmm. I think you do so in a way that is compassionate. And I sometimes in society, people may talk around the truth, or they're afraid to say really what's at the heart of the matter, which I think is probably one reason why people are attracted to wanting to know what you think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I also think that people, of course, I'll often hear from people that, like, well, I read this question in your column, but you don't know the circumstances. And I always say, that's a good thing. Somebody is telling me their story. Mm. It's completely biased. What I try to do, and honestly, years of therapy has helped me to be a good listener.
Mm.
I approach all of the questions sent to me as a reader. I think that I came into the job as a very, very good reader. And so I do think I decode language. I do think that, like a good therapist, I will discover the underlying issue.
Yeah.
And I'll bring it up in my answer.
Yeah. 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 Are you ever able to turn it off? Meaning, if you're at a party or in some social setting, I imagine two different things. One, when people find out who you are, it's like a doctor, like, oh my gosh, I've got something they need to ask you.
It's more like a vet.
Yeah.
People are always like, I feel like first of all, most often when people sort of figure out who I am and what I do, they challenge me. It is not like a doctor where the people will be like, will you look at my rash? People often want to challenge me and disagree with my point of view, disagree with, and really sort of engage in a dialogue with me about how they perceive my biases. Yeah.
Huh.
So that's a lot of fun for me.
Are you able, if you're in a, and if they don't know who you are, and if you hear a scenario or something like that, do you go into Ask Amy mode and think, well, if they ever asked me this question or brought this scenario, how would I respond to it? Or are you able to kind of like, no, I'm done with that for the day?
I very much try not to do that.
Okay.
I actually have a little post-it over my desk that says, unsolicited advice is always unwelcome,
yeah.
basically. I try very hard not to do that. But there are times when I'll say, oh, I received a question for my column on that topic. And, you know, if you're interested in knowing, you know, how I answered, just let me know. I do have people. Actually, this became a big problem when I worked in the building at the Chicago Tribune. I had a lot of colleagues coming to me really, I felt like Lucy Van Pelt. They would come in, close the door.
Give you their nickel.
Give me my nickel. And it made me very uncomfortable because in a couple of cases, these were colleagues who were unburdening things that were very personal. Mm. And I just knew they would regret it. Mm. So I very quickly developed a technique for dealing with that. In one case with one colleague, he seemed to see me as his personal sounding board. And I just basically said, look, if you have a question for me, write it up and I'll consider it for my column.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I kept the intake number. I developed a relationship with a psychologist at Northwestern, and he gave me a number to give to people.
Oh, that's great.
And that was a way for me to sort of skirt around some of the personal challenges of working with people who had unburdened themselves to me. Fortunately for me, in a way, my instinct from the start was, you don't want to sit here and tell me these deeply personal things because we're colleagues and you're going to feel weird in the morning. So I figured, I had a sort of a strategy for fending that off. Yeah.
This is one question I didn't give you ahead of time, so it's okay to ask. But I'm also curious about your close relationships and how have those been affected by what you do, meaning you're either in your marriage or your children or whatever. I don't know if sometimes they feel like, I don't know. I'm curious if it's
test subjects.
Yeah.
Fortunately for me, my second marriage is to somebody who's just has a tremendous amount of native, what I would just call gifts. He's just really smart, and I think he is gifted in certain regards. Shamelessly used my column early in my marriage to try to connect with my new stepdaughters. I have four stepdaughters. And I would bring questions to them at the table and say, oh, here's one. What do you think? And it really got us on the same page. Huh. I learned a lot about them by just asking them how they would answer a question. And honestly, I used a lot of their, advice, and they taught me a lot. So in that sense, I think the column really helped me to enter this family system in a way that was really positive, that involved me doing more listening than telling. My husband and I faced a really, series of really huge challenges. And I think during that time of really high stress, I got a little know-it-all-y. And that's not the way to be.
Yeah.
I don't like dealing with people who have all the answers.
Right.
And I had to really train myself not to be that way. On the other hand, I got to say, writing this column has taught me so, so much. I, honest to God, think I am a stronger person. I won't say I'm a better person, but I'm definitely a stronger person. I'm so much more informed about my own challenges. And for instance, when I faced challenges that I wasn't ready for, like elder care, being with my mother when she died, dealing with my siblings, when I faced those challenges that I wasn't ready for, I used what I learned in the column. And I'm really proud of that.
Yeah.
I'm really proud of that.
Yeah. I'd like to talk about your faith life, if that's okay. This was my wife's, reaching out to you is actually my wife's idea, because she read one of your columns where, I don't know if you explicitly said the Methodist Church, but you said something to the effect of, I belong to a church that's fighting about LGBT issues, something like that. And it was right around the time that the Methodist Church was fighting about this. And my wife said, you know what? I bet Amy's a Methodist. I have a much deeper question to ask in a minute, but first I'm curious about, if you don't mind, talking about your own faith life and how that, did you grow up religious? Or did it come later in life?
I, I grew up in the Methodist Church. I come from a tiny little farming rural village in upstate New York, and where my family's lived since 1790. And I was raised in this church by a very skeptical, I would say non-religious mother. Hmm. But we connected through music. I'm from a very musical family, and I grew up singing in the choir, all of those amazing John Wesley hymns, and so I came in through music. So I had a sneaky way into faith. I went to Georgetown for college, which is a school that was very steeped in sort of Catholic Jesuit yeah. tradition. And I've just always been a churchgoer. Everywhere I've ever lived, I just go to church. Mm. And I'm now living back in my hometown and deeply involved in this tiny, dying Methodist church. I just actually last week took over as the head of the PPR committee as we are trying to save this church.
Yeah.
Ironically, or maybe mysteriously, or maybe logically, my faith seems to have grown the more I struggle with the church itself because we have had... you know, these tiny rural churches, you get clergy who are too young. You get clergy who are too old. We had a clergy member steal from us.
Oh my.
I mean, we have been through, as I say, more bad partners than in an Edith Wharton novel, you know? But we had a young guy come in 5 years ago, and he was like a St. Bernard puppy. Mm. Just fresh, starting out, fumbling and bumbling, telling too many jokes. But he was the first pastor we'd ever had in this buttoned-down little rural church. He was the first pastor we ever had who just... He started out on his first Sunday saying, "I love you. I don't know you, but I love you." Huh. And he just, I thought that was beautiful. Mm. I'd never heard that. We came up from this very hyper-traditional church, and I thought that was fantastic. Mm. And I have tried to deal with the many, many, many challenges of trying to keep this church alive. I've dealt with them I've tried to just be loving and prayerful. That's different.
Yeah.
We're so running out of juice. It's quite sad. Yeah. But we had this wonderful music director, and of course I'm in the choir, and we got a new clergy, and the choir director left very suddenly. And now there are 10 people in the choir, and there are usually 15 people in the congregation. And the people in the choir, we have been singing together. I went to high school with all of them. So these are very long-standing yeah. relationships. Our choir director left. We could not find anyone. And I decided to do something I've never done. I beat the bushes looking for music help. Couldn't find anyone. And I just decided... Well, I'm going to do what people say you're supposed to do. I'm just going to pray on this and we'll just hope for the best.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, I mean, literally 10 minutes after I said that to myself, someone from the choir emerged that I didn't even know could play the piano.
Okay.
Sort of emerged and said, I'll give it a try. And we've been kind of, you know, fumbling along ever since. But I just, that was different.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes when you don't have an answer, I faced this when I was trying to overfunction for my entire family during a really stressful time. And I just took a look at my own behavior and how I was feeling and how anxious I was all the time. And I just thought, I need to find a different way to cope.
Hmm.
And I just started backing off and doing more like prayer and reflection.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah. And it seems to...
I don't know. I don't know.
We talk about this prayer, quote unquote, work. And so that's hard to answer that. But it seems like it's had an effect, a good effect. Yeah.
Right. Especially if your intentions are to do your best.
Sure. Yeah.
And to let other people do their best. And to give everybody a effing break.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And to give yourself a break.
Yeah. Yeah. So then one of the biggest theological questions that we ask ourselves, all of us, people of faith, are the kind of nature of humanity. There's some traditions that talk about nature, or that people are naturally evil, or that they are good, or some combination of the both. In the years that you've written your column, and you've seen, I would imagine, all kinds of behavior, how would you answer that question?
Oh, without a doubt, I think that people are naturally good. I absolutely believe that. And maybe as a pastor, you feel like you have the same sort of insight, but I feel like the more insight I get into human nature, the more I believe that, plus as a parent, I mean, look at a baby, please, you know, I just believe that the world makes us. I had the kind of childhood that a lot of people would think was very disadvantaged, but I was incredible. I mean, I hit the jackpot because I had one great parent, you know? And so I already had a leg up on scores of babies born, you know? I already got lucky because I was born into a really rock solid, fantastic family. Very disadvantaged in many, many ways, but temperamentally really loving, kind, smart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lucky.
I appreciate you saying that, because reading a couple of the articles and you sharing a little bit today of some of the responses you get, people who are angry at you, who in the article I read, somebody, I think I'm remembering this right, either wrote a letter or in the email wrote bullshit on a response. And then you posted it in your office.
It was somebody who like had a stamp, like an ink stamp that said bullshit. And then I think this person had another one that said horse shit.
Yeah.
And would send me postcards with my column cut out and with that stamped on it. I know. You got to love that guy. Right?
But for me, if I were to get that, at the heat of the moment, and maybe you were the same way, you're like, who is this? And what kind of person would do this? But maybe upon reflection, your response, you got to love the guy, because maybe not many people do.
Right. That's part of it. But also, here's my standard. I developed this very early on when I would, and if I'm as triggered as anybody by responses that are very unkind. And I started this in the very early days of my column. I respond to every unkind email I receive.
Really?
And I often say to people, I'm a human being. This is hurtful. And I offer them an opportunity to have a dialogue. I am not kidding. This was not my reasoning. My reason for doing this was not because I was trying to win fans. But
right.
I will tell you this. 98% of the people are like, oh my God, I love you. I can't believe you did that. Often I'll say, do me a favor and reread what you wrote to me.
Yeah.
And people, I now feel like that's my like mitzvah. Like I'm giving them an opportunity to reflect, and they apologize.
Mm.
And I always say, I appreciate that you did that, you know? And we're all better, right, for doing that. And these aren't... these aren't for publication. This sure. is just in my abundant free time, you know. But it also helps me to climb off the ledge if I feel like I'm being authentically like, hey, this really hurts my feelings. Like, yeah. what's up with you? You
but know, what a great response to. It's like a third, as I perceive it, a wonderful third way of you can either respond and say you're a jerk, or you can go too far the other way and like try to appease them.
Right.
Or I love the phrase, I'm going to give you a chance to reflect on this.
Yeah.
And let's take another shot at this. And is this really what you wanted to say?
And so many people, I think the rise of social media and this all this anonymous communicating we do, so many people feel that they are just shouting into the void.
Right.
And so if I respond and say I'm a human being, they're shocked.
Mm-hmm.
Truly. In fact, I love these emails. I'll get emails from people like, "Dear Amy, well, you're one of your staff members, please XYZ." And I respond, I say, "I don't have any staff members. I wish I did. Because if I had a staff, I would get them on. I would get them on it." But yeah. And this just, you know, I just think it's great that people know I'm a person.
Yeah. And that somebody's listening.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think that's right. I think people shouting out in the void, partly because they don't feel like anyone is. And so maybe it's just a desperate hope, an attempt, like, somebody please listen to what I'm saying.
You have to have, you know, I said that I'm musical. Mm-hmm. And I really think that you have to have a good ear.
Mm.
Because on Twitter, for instance, I, you know, occasionally we'll get trolled, and I can tell the difference between a trolling and a sort of upset, angry
yeah.
person.
Okay.
And they're very different. And I respond to trolling by muting or blocking. But people who are just pissed off at me, I'll engage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I always end these conversations by asking my guests to share a story of failure. And so I open it up to however they want to answer that, whether it's personal, professional, as a child, last week, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So would you mind sharing one of your own failure stories?
Yeah. I was thinking about this just this morning. I think being in Chicago, where I lived for many years, really brings back a lot for me, brings up a lot. And if you ask me about failure, without question, the very first thing that comes to my mind is my divorce. Mm. I can still sob about my divorce. And I have been very happily remarried for over 10 years. Mm. But my divorce, which happened almost 30 years ago, remains just this tremendous regret for me. And it wasn't because I caused it. But I was a party to a relationship that failed very dramatically. Mm. And I'm so sorry about that. Mm. I continue to believe that, it needn't have failed. I think that my ex and I actually could have had a very successful marriage if only I'd had the maturity of a 60-year-old woman at the time, you know. I mean, there were a number of factors, but I would, without question, I think that's my biggest personal failure for sure.
As you reflect on it then, do you think, it sounds like you have it a little bit, as you've gone back and think about how did the marriage fail, but then your own kind of, where did I fail in the midst of this? And I would imagine, as with anyone too, you look at the other person too, and like, how did they fall short? How did they fail?
Right. And in my case, I realized with total clarity that I carried the trauma from my childhood right into a marriage.
Mm.
I did a great job of choosing a partner who was the polar opposite of my own father, who had really traumatized our family. I did a really smart thing by choosing somebody very different, but I never dealt with the issues.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I entered a marriage, I think, very hurt by the only other man I'd ever known, who was my father. And I think I was wounded and I was not able to communicate about my own wounds. And it was, we were so waspy. Like, we never fought. We never, I mean, I was married to somebody who, like me, did not want to talk about tough things or didn't know how to talk about tough things and also lacked the tools. So, yeah, we were quite the pair.
Well, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Amy Dickinson, thank you so much for taking the time to be on this podcast.
I really enjoyed it. Yeah. My pleasure. I just love what you're doing.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks. And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Amy for giving her time for this conversation. To learn more about her books or read her columns, you can go to her website, amydickinson.com, and also follow her on Twitter, @AskingAmy. I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast, as my next conversation will be with Diana Garber, author of the book Raising Humans in a Digital World, where we'll talk about how to negotiate raising children in our rapidly changing technological society. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to my website, christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.